keep it alive. Through these lines I write, I keep it live, cause I thrive. I might just blow your mind tonight. I'm so hyped, but it's no hype. From this height, it's direct hits on sight. I'm your type, lend me your ears to show you that there's something in me. I'm not giving up, I'm standing right here, holding these days hostage, and I'll make this my year. We turning fear into love, and the love's in the air. I love doing this cause nothing compares, nothing can share that same type of feeling when you're feeling them flares. They can't catch it, it's havoc. I rip to a tear, switch a scenario. My stereos, I leave them impaired. Variables start to change, and they're all in my range. I just gotta grab it, it's all mathematics. Every step is drastic, I make it fantastic. I'm trying to take your breath away, asthmatic.
This is live through the stereo. Go and let it blow, blow through the stereo. I'ma let them know, no through the stereo. Yo, here we go, go through the stereo, stereo. This is live through the stereo. Go and let it blow, blow through the stereo. I'ma let them know, no through the stereo. Yo, here we go, go through the stereo, stereo.
Yeah. Just nod your head with it, so explicit and vivid. Every image is intricate, intimate. I put my all into it, no scrimmage and no rules. I'm a pro tool, hear my heartbeat beat into the vocals. I'm so loco, lost my mind, oh no. It's ponderoso, dope so, no overdose cause it's dope. Yo man, this is house grown, mixed with some milestones. So I let the style flow, down like the Dow Jones. Bringing it with some foul tones, letting the crowd know we getting loud, so it's eardrum rudiments. Yeah, we bring it rude again. Move, little hooligan. Music for tuning in. Full time to the 10. I'm on my clock, like I told you. I'm doing this for dreams we pursue.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the Anti-Media Radio Show. Once again with your host, Nick Burnaby, here on UCY.TV or theantimedia.org/radio. Really happy to be back, and I'm glad everybody's back tuning in, and we've got a great show lined up. A lot of stuff going on, as usual, all around the world, here in the United States, foreign policy, you name it. We're going to be talking about a bunch of stuff tonight here on the Anti-Media Radio. Make sure you catch us 5 days a week here on UCY.TV. And you could also, if you miss any of our shows, you can catch us on YouTube as well. You know, just to stay up to date. We're talking about a lot of stuff going on week after week, show after show, Monday through Friday here at the same time. So make sure you keep track of everything going on, because some of these topics are, you know, we've been talking about for a couple of years now, and they're just starting to, like, you know, manifest themselves and materialize. Really, really interesting analysis that we've been really staying on top of here at the Anti-Media on the geopolitical end of the spectrum. But anyway, with that being said, let me introduce my longtime co-host, DB Schwartz. What's up, man?
Not much, Nick. Just glad to have made it through a ridiculous monsoon from last Wednesday that came out of nowhere and basically got me stuck, so I really couldn't call in or do anything, actually. So pretty interesting times up here where there's real weather.
Yeah, sucks for you, man. I mean, we're out here in San Diego. We're just dealing with a minor heat wave. It's like 85 degrees or so. And yeah, here on the coast, that is kind of a heat wave for us.
I'll tell you what, though. I'll take the water any day over the drought.
Yeah, true. You know, unless you got a major excess of water, which is unfortunately what's going on right now down in Louisiana, man. Really sad situation down in Louisiana. A bunch of flooding. From what I've read, there's like 10,000 people that are been basically forced out of their homes and are like now living in shelters. And then, you know, thousands and thousands of people have been, you know, displaced and stuff like that. So, you know, keep
the same response. Where's FEMA?
I'm sure they'll be there in a couple months to give out a bunch of messed up trailer park homes. Yeah, where is FEMA? That's a good question. These agencies are supposedly there to be answering to you know, these issues, but you know they have no problem calling up the National Guard from Milwaukee, right? But you know, it's a lot slower when there's a legitimate catastrophe going on. It's for some reason it's like the resources aren't there, but I mean, what kind of budget does FEMA have? I mean, these are billions and billions of dollars that this agency receives every year. Where the hell are they? Why aren't they helping people? It seems like a lot of people that are actually going out and rescuing people are just volunteers, you know, people just grabbing a boat and going out there and helping people that are stuck in the flooding, you know, everyday heroes that are really out there doing what needs to be done. So, you know, that's the side of thing.
You know what happened after Katrina, Nick? Because I went the year before Katrina, and then I went like 5 years ago. And it totally wiped out all the mom-and-pop places. It just generally became like a chain or just another chain. You know, even if you go down to the French Quarter, like there's chains there now and there's big business there. And it quite literally washed away all the monopoly competition. And I have to think every time these things happen and more of these mom-and-pop places get wiped out and people lose their entire house and all their stuff and everything, you know, there's no rush to help because there's too much money being made.
Yeah, it's an interesting factor. I never really thought of it that way. But, yeah, I mean, it's easy for Walmart to bounce back and rebuild and restock. It's a lot harder for... you know, a mom and pop business, and a lot of the insurance that people have, especially, it's really sad, you know, people in flood prone areas, it's really tough for them to actually get flood insurance, or it's really expensive because it happens so often. You know, and a lot of Louisiana is like below sea level and stuff, and that's why the flooding gets so bad out there. And, you know, once again, just really, really messed up situation. Luckily, there's only been 7 reported deaths. I'm sure the toll will go up when they start identifying missing people and stuff like that. But I've also seen a lot of reports about like pets and animals that are being, you know, caught in the flooding too. So a lot of bad destruction going on down there. But, you know, I'm sure they'll pull through it. We're working on some stuff right now that we're trying to sponsor to try to get some help to the people in need out there. Because like you said, you know, FEMA is not really doing its job, and, you know, these bureaucrats aren't going to be nimble enough to go and start addressing what's going on down there. So we're going to try to put together some kind of campaign with the anti-media and a few of our partners to, like, you know, raise some resources for people that are affected out there. So, well,
I hate to say it too, Nick, because I love that area, and I have friends, especially in Houston, which were basically the absorbers of half of New Orleans after Katrina, and their city grew exponentially and changed like overnight. And, you know, what you can see is that Delta land is just being reclaimed by the at this point, the Gulf. Like, there's not a lot we're going to be able to do to save Florida, to save most of that southern part of Louisiana. Like, it's just going to come. You can only dredge so much. So I think they need to come up with a permanent solution to possibly superfund a lot of these southern states so they can give people money to get out of there.
Yeah, and, you know, the sea levels are rising because the climate is getting warmer and stuff like that. Or, you know, the climate is just getting more unpredictable, to say the least. I mean, you know, of course, everyone's a skeptic, and, you know.
We're heading to an ice age, Nick. Every time the planet heats up like this, and trust me, we have artificially accelerated it, there becomes a real ice age. We had the mini one in the 1700s where it was like 40 years of winter, where it was like 8 months a year where it was cold. If we go into something like that again, that may be why they're putting that big seed vault up there in Norway and obviously building a bunch of dumbs on deep underground military bases and such. And obviously rich people have their escape plans to get, you know, to different parts of the world when the shift happens or this change happens. But that's what we're seeing, man. The Earth is responding to, I guess, what could be called the equilibrium being disturbed, and now it's going to start cooling off. Yeah, we're going to have decades still of heat, but what you're going to see is rising sea levels, and what's that going to do? Naturally, more water, more heat dissipation, and then you get a swing to the other side of the pendulum.
Yeah, I mean, in the longer term, I've seen some researchers talk about that, how we may be heading to an ice age, you know, relatively soon. But yeah, in the near term, we're definitely dealing with, you know, accelerated warming from a lot of the, you know, pollution and just chopping down the forests and all this stuff that humans have done through the process of industrialization and all that stuff. You know, there's no doubt that we've accelerated the destruction of the Earth. I mean,
all to be avoided if we just let Tesla's patents out, but Edison wouldn't do it, that son of a bitch.
Seriously, right? You know, there is plenty of progress being made. I saw that Scotland was provided all of its energy for a whole day just on wind energy creation. So that's pretty interesting. A lot of tidal type of generation innovation right now, and of course the solar revolution. I just saw that Tesla is talking about coming out, or Solar City, one of Elon Musk's companies. They're talking about coming up with solar-powered roof paneling, so basically like roof tiles for your house. So instead of having like solar panels separate from your roof or attached to your roof or somewhere else on your property, like your actual roof will be built out of solar paneling. So that's pretty interesting. You know, and all this stuff, you know, it should be embraced, because generating your own electricity at home is just, it's such a huge freedom conducting type of technology. I mean, it reduces your reliance on the grid, which is going to be, you know, a major source of contention in a time of panic, or, you know, for instance, like with all this flooding going on down in Louisiana, I'm sure a bunch of people had their power knocked out. You know, I'm sure a bunch of power stations have been, you know, short-circuited by the water and flooding, and I'm sure a bunch of, you know, telephone wires, telephone poles have been knocked over by the floods. I mean, very, very strong example as to why we need to get self-sustainable. And I, you know, it's important to note that it's not just about green energy, because if we get green energy and we base it on the same exact model that we have now, where it's like very centralized and the power company owns all the infrastructure and you buy your power from the power company, well, you're not really addressing the underlying issue here, which is over-centralization of the, you know, of the necessities. I mean, the more necessities that we can provide from the local level, be it, you know, from your own home or from the community level, the better, because then you don't have to rely on bureaucrats or monopolies or any of these other things that are notoriously corruptible. And I mean, when you have a centralized bureaucracy, it's just inherently flawed. So if you could decentralize down to the ultimate level, which is down to the individual level, I mean, that's just going to help you become more independent from everything, and everyone knows independence helps you maintain your freedom.
Nick, yesterday I saw a home out here that was just flush, and a solar panel array in the backyard had a huge generator, and on the outside of the house was a visible Tesla, one of the first packs I'd seen, and it's, you know, good priced neighborhood, $300,000-$400,000 homes. But what I realized is, when there's a hiccup like we talked about a week ago in any of the supply chains, and there's a power interruption, especially a place like up here where the cold can kill, really, or even where the heat can kill, like Arizona, these people that are set up, that had the money to do it, basically the working wealthy, they're going to basically be able to kind of weather through it, and the rest of the people won't. And that's the kind of weird technocracy that's going to separate us as a society very soon. I mean, you have to imagine that the immortal banker scenario is probably upon us. Like, I don't think that a guy who's 50 years old right now and he's a billionaire, I don't necessarily think he's going to die. I think there's going to be like life extension stuff coming out within the next 20 years that'll just keep him going. And I think we're getting into that kind of sci-fi stuff. But on a real level, I mean, people with the money are going to kind of be, you set a greenhouse up, you dig a well, you have radiant heat, you have solar panels, you still go to work, you still drive a car. If anything happens, you don't care.
Yeah, I mean, interesting point. The problem is that, you know, people that have these kind of setups, as you said, the guy, the person in the house you saw had, were you talking about one of those Tesla Powerwall things?
Exactly, a Tesla pack. So, like, what it was doing was, it was actually, I guess what it does is it converts the energy and stores it. So while you're not using it, it's a really hyper-advanced, super-plasmic battery pack that essentially can hold like 10 times what it should for its size, because it's not super big. And then what it does is, when you're, you know, when you're away from your house, your solar panels are kicking power back to the grid. So this fool's probably making money every month.
Yeah, those are really cool. And they're not too expensive either for the Tesla Powerwall thing. I think that's what
they're like, $3,000 or something.
And so, like, you know, while you're at work, it'll fully charge itself up and store energy, and then when you get home and the sun goes down, I mean, it's packed with energy, and you can use that all night, and, you know, it helps you get off the grid, basically.
It charges right into the Tesla too, Nick, the Tesla car. So I mean, you're essentially off grid with, I don't know, maybe a couple hundred grand of investment, which it's within reach of a good amount of people. And I'm starting to see these setups happening where it's not more along the lines of like, oh, I'm going to be an urban survivalist and make it through an apocalypse. It's literally down to I'm making $200-$400 a month back from the power company. This is how the wealthy get rich.
Yeah. Now the problem is that, as you were saying, you could like see what this guy had from outside, and if something were to go down, I mean, I'm sure people would be coming to his place, knocking on his door, looking for, you know, to share in his prosperity or whatever you want to call it.
Well, you know, extremely heavily armed and, up here, but
that's why the focus should also be on, you know, not only self-reliance and self-sustainability, but also community self-sustainability as well. That way, entire communities are safe and insulated from any, you know, outside, you know, major issues, economic crisis, financial crisis, you know, power outages. That way you can have your whole community protected and stuff, and you don't got to worry about being the only guy on the block with a solar panel, because then everybody's going to want to become charging their phones, or, you know, that's in the best case scenario. Worst things can happen.
Or get everybody on those setups. See, we have these early adopters, and they're showing people how it's done. Hey, not only are you impervious to the power grid, you make money back.
Exactly. And, you know, I can't stress it enough how important it is for this kind of decentralization to happen. I've got an interesting story here to continue this this idea of self-reliance. This was published on our sister site, undergroundreporter.org. In fact, DB, this happened. This is going down over near you're at. You may know. You may be aware of this. There's over 24 rural towns in southern Minnesota that were having trouble getting reliable internet connections from the corporate provider. And when they did get internet, it was slow. It was, you know, spotty coverage and stuff like that. They built a community-owned fiber optic internet network for their towns. So this is a really awesome development. Again, it goes away from this corporate model of highly centralized, and it goes into this kind of cooperativist idea where the communities can come together in common interests and can kind of, you know, take care of the infrastructure that needs to be taken care of without relying on government handouts and without relying on these big corporations. One thing to note here is that these communities did all of this internet infrastructure without a single penny in government funding. You know, they did it all themselves. It was essentially, you know, crowdfunded, kind of, you know, just like what is being done with like Kickstarter and these kind of ideas. But this was just done at the community level. They all realized that they needed better internet. A lot of these are like farming towns and stuff, very rural areas. And they were like, you know what, why don't we all just pitch in and build our own internet? And they did. And it's a lot faster than the crap that they were getting from the corporate provider.
Yeah, Nick, yesterday I saw a satellite array in someone's backyard, full blown. I mean, so now with that, you can get on the internet through the satellite, and then you're impervious to any local infrastructure at all. So there's plenty of World War II satellites out there that are just sitting there waiting for someone to retrofit them and jury-rig them. I'm sure this guy got every channel in the world in his house. So, I mean, there's ways around it, and the technology's old. It's really old. It's actually, you kind of go back. I mean, you can get by with ham radios. They can't hack those. They can't block them. They don't know a way to shift radio waves or screw up transmissions that way anymore. No one knows the old school stuff. So, yeah, I mean, self-reliance is going to come back in a real way for people, unless you want to be barcoded and have a microchip. I mean, that's what it seems like the big cities have in store for us.
Yeah, and that's you bring up another good point, is this is also a way to get around censorship and stuff like that. Again, moving away from this heavy-handed federal policies, whether it's on energy policies or, you know, energy monopolies or internet monopolies, or, you know, relying on the FCC and all that stuff, and now we're dealing with it with the TPP and it's how it's going to affect internet stuff. You know, decentralizing on the internet side of things is also good to protect freedom of speech and to really put the democratic process back into the hands of the people, because really, that's the only way that we're going to take back any semblance of a democratic society is through economics. And, you know, the community is really going to have to be the source of a lot of these essential needs, as far as, like, if we're looking at power generation, water supply, food supply, and that kind of thing. The community level is really the place where we need to do the work. I mean, we don't need to vote for some politician that says he's going to do this or do that. I mean,
the water part is the one that freaks me out the most, just knowing all you guys are so vulnerable to the Colorado River, the one place pumping it in, and you only have 2 years of supply if it stops. I mean, there's a lot of pockets around the world right now that are supplied by the denser rainfall areas, and they're completely dependent on that supply to keep pumping, and that's going to be used as a weapon one way or another. I mean, what is Nestle doing right now but not just draining out aquifers all over the country, and then the frackers come in and poison wherever that water used to be, and guess what? Now all the water's corporately owned. There's some communities like Flint where you cannot drink, and they can't fix it. And I don't know if you've been keeping up on Flint, Nick, but Flint is a gut job for the plumbing supply of a city that's built on top of it. In other words, it can't be fixed. It's going to leach that lead until it all the way corrodes, and then there'll be no more plumbing system at all. So Flint as a whole city is already a Superfund site. Of course they're not going to do that. They're not going to pay 200,000 or 300,000 people money to move out, but all those people are stuck perpetually poisoned, and especially their children are very, very badly affected by it. And we need to come up with solutions. Like, New Era Detroit's nearby. There's got to be ways where we can come up with, because there's plenty of rainfall in Detroit. They don't need the city supply. What they need is a community-based solution where people can start deep drilling wells on their property and going back old school again.
I mean, Detroit is sitting on the Great Lakes. I mean, it's literally on one of the biggest supplies of fresh water in the world. I mean, yeah, the Great Lakes are all messed up and they've been polluted and stuff. But it's absolutely ridiculous. And you know, I'm sure everyone's heard about all those stories about Detroit. Now, you know, Flint's kind of close to Detroit, but Detroit, you know, all those people were having their water shut off and stuff, and they had all these huge water bills. And it's like, dude, these guys are sitting on the largest fresh body of water, you know, one of the largest in the world, and they're not being able to get water. And what the hell is going on here? Obviously, there's a major issue here with the bureaucracy involved and stuff. And again, goes back to this problem with the water monopolies and the bureaucracy. Many, many places, especially big cities, their water supplies are governed by, like, elected officials, and, you know, it's all part of the government bureaucracy there that really decides how to distribute the water, how to charge for it, how to price it, and all that stuff. And, you know, like you said, the water, it's so important, and it's not something to be in the hands of either monopolistic corporations or dumb, you know, bureaucracies. Now, the problem that we face around here in San Diego, where we're, you know, engulfed in this drought, I mean, they just finished building a desalination plant, which, you know, desalination, it's a controversial practice because it's so resource intensive to desalinate ocean water. But again, instead of the community coming together and crowdsourcing a desalination plant, it's outsourced to a big corporation that gets, you know, government subsidies. And then at the same time, the water pricing is handled by, you know, the government, who fixes the water rates and stuff like that. And the same government officials that dictate these water pricing rates are heavily influenced by, you know, the lobbyists from this industry.
And they're a monopoly that's unnecessary, Nick. You know, being in the business I'm in now, I start researching things like wells. And now there's forever wells where they're made out of composites that don't break down or decay for 1,000 years. I mean, they're truly maintenance-free, will never leak. I mean, even an earthquake can't crack them. I mean, literally a bomb would have to drop on it for your well to stop working now. Are they pricey? Sure. But what's a water bill? How much do you pay, Nick, for water? I mean, a couple hundred bucks? I mean, over the course of your life, did you spend $200,000 on water? Is a great well $30,000? Yes, it is. And is that free water that's clean for the rest of your life? Probably. So we don't need these systems. I mean, imagine you spend $100,000 to $200,000 in your life on water. That's a house in a lot of parts of the world. So it's a reality, and just that resource. Plus, when you have your own water, you grow your own food. So you can kill two birds with one stone, and then all you have left is energy, which can be supplied now without any of the grid, as long as you have the money to do it, and it's going to keep getting cheaper. And you have completely maintenance-free homes that have radiant heat and cooling that just stay warm and cool, a constant temperature all the time now. So we don't need any of these corporations to live anymore. We only really need them for luxuries. And maybe that's what the future of work is going to be about.
That's definitely the direction that we're going in, because all these robots and stuff are moving in on all the kind of laborious jobs and stuff like that. So, you know, it's a very real possibility that there will be very little jobs left, you know, in the traditional sense. And most of the jobs, you know, remaining will be recreational based, you know, luxurious stuff, things that, you know, people could use but aren't necessary, or, you know, creative work and stuff like that. Even that is coming under the influence of robotics and automation, AI. I saw that the Washington Post actually has robotic reporters covering the Rio Olympics. Now, of course, it's mostly statistical stuff. You know, who got a gold medal? Who did this? Who did that? But, you know, even though a lot of the creative work is going to be done by robots pretty soon. So, you know, that's going to be very interesting stuff. And this is one thing that these candidates aren't really addressing at all, is, you know, automation. I think maybe Bernie Sanders kind of touched on it a little bit when, you know, before he sold out and endorsed Hillary Clinton. But automation is probably one of the biggest economic and therefore political factors that is going to be facing the United States. And, you know, the most likely scenario, if things continue the way they're going right now, is that, you know, there's going to be a major issue of unemployment over the next decade, two decades. And then it's going to be just more big government solutions. You know, the jobs get taken up by the robots. Everybody, a bunch of people are unemployed. Government has to give out a bunch of welfare, unemployment, and all that stuff. And it's just going to make the problem that we're dealing with right now a lot worse, because, you know, obviously the more people that we have dependent on government subsidies, the less opposition there will be to any kind of tyrannical government actions, which, you know, are happening pretty much all the time. Looking at the news that we got recently, a bunch of kids are now dying over in Yemen because of the U.S.-backed, you know, U.S.-backed Saudi-led coalition in Yemen is bombing hospitals. They bombed a place that was, you know, the opposition claims was a school. The Saudis say that it was a training camp for child soldiers, which, of course, is a very opportunistic claim. You know, this is just continuous, man, continuous. And, you know, all the things that we were just talking about regarding, you know, dependence on the government or dependence on corporate monopolies, which, you know, really is an extension of the government at this point, they're going to make us more vulnerable to allowing this just atrocities to happen all around the world. And, you know, this thing going on in Yemen, it's very much underreported. The media won't really talk about it at all. But, you know, there's been reports of U.S. advisors literally in the control rooms where they're calling the shots on these airstrikes. And again, a Doctors Without Borders hospital was blown up. And all of this because the Saudis want to have their friendly dictator in charge of Yemen. And there's been a popular uprising by the Houthi rebels, which are, you know, now being backed by Iran and by proxy, probably Russia. Again, this is another proxy war that's kind of like what's going on in Syria, except Yemen started off already in a much worse situation. You know, Syria was like pretty nice at one point before this major civil war broke out. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't a first world country, but it was, you know, pretty nice. Bunch of big cities and a decent standard of living for many people. Yemen has been embroiled in conflict for a long time. Terrorism, suicide bombings. The U.S. has been drone bombing the place ever since, you know, the start of the war on terror. Saudi Arabia has been maintaining basically a puppet government over there for a long time. And now, you know, people got fed up and they kicked the dictator out. He fled to Saudi Arabia. And now these Houthi rebels are trying to take over the country. And the Saudi coalition with the U.S. technology, U.S. surveillance, including probably, they're probably coordinating U.S. drone strikes now against the Houthis, as long as they can claim that it's against Al-Qaeda. I'm sure they're getting away with it. The interesting thing here with what's going on in Yemen is that basically what you have going on is the Houthi rebels are actually also fighting against Al-Qaeda and the other type of Sunni terror groups over there. So the U.S., again, is kind of aligned with the so-called terrorists that we're supposed to be fighting against in the war against terror, you know, which is pretty much the same thing going on in Syria. But yeah, we've kind of aligned ourselves with Al-Qaeda in Yemen because Saudi Arabia and them, they share ideological principles, but they're both fighting the same battle, so they're fighting alongside each other. So, you know, very little coverage of this, but it's just so hypocritical what's going on over there. And the media, once again, is just giving a pass to these atrocities and not really calling it out for what it is. I mean, I saw a bunch of, if you look on Google News right now, you'll see this reported where it says, you know, oh, hospital bombed in Yemen. I'm looking at a title right here from the New York Times. Airstrike hits aid group's hospital in Yemen, 11 killed. You click on the article and you got to go like halfway through it near the bottom before you find out, oh, it was Saudi Arabia that dropped the bomb. And then nowhere in the article does it say the U.S. is backing the Saudi Arabian bombing of these hospitals. So, you know, the media is distorting the coverage here. I mean, I guess they don't want to humanize what's going on there, that the U.S. is, you know, really supplying the weapons and the technology for this, you know, what's quickly becoming a massive slaughter, just wholesale bombing of cities and schools and hospitals and stuff like that. You know, and
but
it's just
Saudi Arabia is losing badly.
They are
in a conventional war because Iran's just a much, people don't understand, like Iran and Iraq, when they had their war, it really did, what it did was it created the modern Iranian military because they're like, oh crap, if we have a problem with Iraq, we could get, you know, overrun by anyone. So it forced them to modernize, and now they're, you know, they're probably like the fifth or sixth best in the world. They're definitely, even though Saudi Arabia spends more, they're not nearly as good. So it's bad news, man, because if they invade Saudi Arabia, we can only assume they have nuclear weapons. I'm guessing they could have, at this point, bought them on the black market, something maybe when Russia broke apart or the USSR broke apart. So I have no doubt in my mind they may have a handful, if not more, and might use them to stop in advance of some of their cities falling to the Houthi rebels. Because the Houthi rebels are really the Iranian special forces and a bunch of guys that are just like over it. They're like, you're going to kill us anyway, so we might as well invade as deep into Saudi Arabia as we can. And they are, and it's not getting into the media at all.
Yeah, and that's why Saudis are taking such a hard line against these Houthi rebels, is because, you know, if you look at the map, Yemen is right there on the edge of Saudi Arabia. I mean, it shares a border there. So, you know, these guys have and they will be trying to launch attacks.
And it's tough, Nick, because it's like Afghanistan, like all those mountains. So, like, you're coming from the desert and trying to go up into the mountains and fight these dudes, and what can you do but bomb them? And they just keep doing that. But all that really does is make the civilian population support the rebels, because now you're bombing innocents. It's like in Afghanistan and Iraq. We could never, ever win hearts and minds when we drone strike, because people are like, you don't give a shit about us. You'll kill us too for no reason. And they'll never, ever support your regime change if you kill innocent civilians.
Exactly. It's just more endless war. I mean, now the Saudis are actually in there and they are trying to win this war, I think. The U.S. and the military industrial complex is sitting back, and they're just like loving the fact that so many bombs are being dropped, because every time a bomb is dropped, that's another sale. You know, that's more better stock prices for them. I mean, when these kind of conflicts, you know, intensify, these guys, their stock prices go up. They love this stuff. You know, and now cities are being destroyed in Yemen, and these poor kids are just being blown to bits. And it's just really sad to see it play out. And it's really sad to see the media. I mean, they reluctantly cover this stuff. They reluctantly say today, I mean, let me see if there's more headlines here I could look at. Reluctantly, they cover the fact that a hospital was bombed in Yemen, but most of them don't even mention the fact that it was a U.S.-backed coalition that's responsible for it. And if you remember back when the U.S. Bombed that hospital in Afghanistan, that was from Doctors Without Borders. I mean, Doctors Without Borders is pretty outspoken about U.S. foreign policy and this kind of indiscriminate or, you know, accidental bombing. You know that this organization is very critical. I mean, we receive their press releases and stuff. Very critical of anybody dropping bombs in these countries where they're operating. And, you know, for these news reports to kind of obscure the fact that it's the U.S.-backed coalition, it's just really irresponsible. And it just goes to show that these media outlets really are doing what they can to keep the U.S. empire going. They don't want to be critical of it, like, at all. And, you know, that the bombing of the hospital in Afghanistan, that was the U.S.'s, you know, bombing, it took media outlets several days before they would actually put a name on who did it, you know, and everyone's like, oh, well, we don't know. And it's like, no, we know it was the U.S., but they don't want to say it. Because these media outlets, I don't know if it's because they're owned partially by these same media or these same military contractors, or, you know, whatever the deeper reasonings for it. But I mean, these guys are perpetuating the war on terror and the global empire on purpose. And you know, that's one of the reasons I don't like, you know, tooting my own horn or whatever you want to call it. But that's one of the reasons why it's so important to support and read independent media, because, you know, we're able to take the gloves off a little bit and report more truthfully on what's going on with the empire around the world. Because the mainstream media, I mean, this stuff is bought and sold by the military-industrial complex. I mean, if you look back at the post-9/11 Iraq war propaganda, I mean, everybody was in on it. New York Times, even the so-called liberal media was like, let's go bomb the shit out of Iran. We have really, really shabby evidence that later on turned out to be bogus, but it didn't matter. They took everything Bush said at, you know, face value. And Cheney, I think Cheney was worse than Bush. Bush is just a useful idiot. But they took everything these guys were saying at face value and just regurgitated government talking points. And the funny thing is that every time there's a report about Iran or about China, it's like, mainstream U.S. media, it's like, oh, state-run media this, state-run media that. It's like, the New York Times might as well be state-run media. You know, all they do is regurgitate, for the most part, regurgitate government talking points. I mean, I saw a great op-ed in New York Times yesterday about how Hillary Clinton is the ideal Republican nominee, because, I mean, let's face it, she is, when it comes to all the stuff the Republican neoconservatives have been trying to accomplish over the past couple decades, with, you know, rewriting the Middle East in favor of the U.S. foreign policy, and just creating the chaos that they have over there right now, and then just taking all their resources and all that stuff. I mean, Hillary Clinton fits the mold perfectly. Trump doesn't, because he's unpredictable and erratic. And for all we know, Trump's trying to lose the election. I mean, that's a whole other topic. We'll probably talk about that on Wednesday, because we've got a very interesting article coming out about that tomorrow. But, you know, the media, looking at their coverage of Clinton, I mean, God, it's just like the Washington Post might as well be part of the Clinton campaign. I mean, they're so ridiculously in favor of Clinton, and Trump is just such an easy target. I get it. But, you know, the media is like so deeply in the bag for Clinton, just because Trump comes off as such an idiot that's irresponsible, and who knows what he's capable of. And I agree, he is an idiot. He is irresponsible. Who knows what he's capable of? But all impartiality is gone. I mean, the media is now so dedicated to electing Hillary Clinton. There's nothing in the world that's going to stop that from happening. Hillary Clinton is going to be the next president. I mean, for a moment, I was like, okay, maybe Trump could win, just because everything that's happening in the world, the terrorism, the, you know, the economy, everything kind of would, you know, conventional wisdom would say, okay, all of this stuff is going to benefit Trump. Every time there's a terrorist attack, it's going to benefit Trump. Every time ISIS does something, Trump is going to benefit from it, because Clinton, you know, as much as I disagree with Trump, I mean, he said Clinton was the founding father of ISIS. Maybe, you know, maybe not exactly true, but very, very accurate in many ways, because it was Clinton and Obama who really laid the foundation for ISIS to grow out of the chaos that Bush created over in Iraq. So, I mean, Trump says a lot of crazy shit, but, you know, in that case, I have to partially agree with him. I mean, it was the Obama policy helped push in the direction by Hillary Clinton that helped create that chaos over there in Syria. And, you know, a bunch of the dissidents from Iraq that came after the fall of Saddam Hussein moved into Syria, and that's what created ISIS. So in a way, I mean, Hillary Clinton is responsible for the rise of ISIS out of the policies to support the opposition in Syria, to destabilize Syria, opened up a vacuum for this group, which became ISIS, to thrive. And not only that, even worse, I mean, the U.S. was directly aiding groups that wound up becoming ISIS in the hopes of destabilizing Assad, in hopes of overthrowing the government of Syria, which, as we know, is a major, major ally for Russia. I mean, they've got pretty much one of their only military bases outside of Russia. I mean, I guess you can also say Crimea, which is now part of Russia. But, you know, one of Russia's only military bases is in Syria, outside of Russia. And so, you know, everybody knows that it's a huge asset for Russia, and that Russia will pretty much do anything to keep a, you know, friendly government in place over in Syria. Do I think it's right? Do I think it's correct that, you know, that's their policy? You know, a proxy, or, you know, keeping maybe an unpopular dictator in power? No, I think that's wrong. But, you know, it shouldn't be the U.S. policy to go in and play around geopolitically with countries just because they, you know, are geostrategic to our foreign policy or our plans on resource hegemony over in the Middle East and Europe. You know, that's what all this is about, and that's the saddest part of it all. I mean, you know, the situation in Yemen, it's a bit different because, you know, it's regional. Saudi Arabia is right on their border, so obviously they want to, you know, keep a friendly government over there. Again, wrong. They shouldn't be doing that, but, you know, they're going to because it's so close. It's the same kind of thing the U.S. does in Central America and Latin America. Anyone that's close to us, we want to control their government. We want to have a friendly government in place. Saudi Arabia is going to do that, and they're going to keep doing that until, you know, they're finally defeated, or until there's a major concession made, or, you know, whatever is going to happen over there. But Syria, it's much different. I mean, it's very much a piece on the chessboard that needs to be controlled by one of the main players, which, you know, would be the Eastern Bloc, which is like Russia and China, or the Western Bloc, which is like NATO. And it all has to do with the pipelines and stuff that they need. Syria is a very strategic place. All of the land pipelines coming out of the Middle East basically have to go through Syria, because otherwise they would have to try to go over the mountains, very hostile territory in all of, like, Kurdistan and stuff. They don't want stuff going through Kurdistan, because the Kurds have for a long time been a thorn in the side of anybody that's been trying to control them. So they don't want to put the pipelines through Kurdistan. They want to put it through Syria. In order to put it through Syria, because Assad refused the pipeline deals, they have to overturn the government. Like, this is what this is all about. And Russia is, for the longest time, been supplying the natural resources to Europe. I mean, oil, natural gas, you know, all the fuels and fossil fuels that Europe consumes, which, you know, they're probably one of the biggest consumers of fossil fuels in the world. And so Russia basically dominates that market. And if the U.S. is and NATO is successful in overthrowing the government of Syria, well, then Russia loses its, you know, pseudo-monopoly on the natural resources into Europe. You know, and that's basically what this entire thing is about. I mean, Obama goes on TV and says that we need to support democracy and, you know, spread freedom over there. That's all bullshit. I mean, you can't believe a word that they're saying, because it's all bullshit. They're trying to topple that government, and they've been doing it for a long time. I mean, Saddam Hussein was just the first, you know, part of the plan where they were going to go topple Iran and everything. But, you know, Syria has to go first and then Iran. So, you know, this is all geopolitical stuff, and the U.S. is needlessly meddling over there for these resources. And, you know, back to what we were saying at the beginning of the show and why it's so important to embrace decentralized sustainable energy, because then they don't have to have power plays for oil in the Middle East. And then we could stop causing civil wars in places like Syria, which has now claimed more than 300,000 lives, man, and millions of people displaced. And now it's creating this rise of right-wing xenophobia throughout Europe because all these refugees are leaving Syria, leaving North Africa, leaving Libya, another place that we conquered. And they're all flooding into Europe. They're flooding into the United States. And everybody's now all this right-wing xenophobia is sprouting out. And all it is, all the xenophobia is just a side effect of the foreign policy. You know, people don't have an unnecessary hate for Muslim people. They don't have an, just an innate hate for brown people from the Middle East. It doesn't come from nowhere. I mean, people are getting it because they fear that, you know, there's going to be terror attacks. And there's been so much anti-Islamic propaganda ever since 9/11 because they had to dehumanize Muslims so they can get away with the Iraq war and all the atrocities that were going to come along with that. I mean, they knew what was coming. So the New York Times and everybody, you know, all the media outlets had this Islamophobic agenda because it was all part of this dehumanization. And it was successful. And now people are, you know, they look at Muslims as, you know, terrorists. And, you know, you got refugees fleeing their countries that are being destroyed by U.S. proxy wars and Russian proxy wars. They're coming here and they're treated like terrorists. It's like, oh, it's like as if the refugees are the problem, when in reality it's the global empire that is causing the refugee crisis to begin with. I mean, people are so short-sighted, and war has become so acceptable in the United States that people can't even look past, you know, the boats landing here and bringing people, and they can't look and see why are people coming, and it's all a product of the global U.S. empire. It's crazy.
I don't know if you checked out what Manar wrote, Manar Muawesh from Mint Press News, but on her own personal Facebook page, she was writing about how she'd moved back to Palestine when she was 9 years old and stayed there for 4 years, 9 through 13. So she got to understand what it really was, the actual, you know, living through it and seeing what it was. And she asks in her post, you know, will my son, who was born here in the Midwest, ever know what it was like? Will people here ever know what our complacency and our silent consent leads to around the world?
Yeah, exactly, man. I mean, it's just incomprehensible what we're allowing to happen, be it in Yemen or, you know, now we got troops in Libya, we're bombing in Libya, Somalia, Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, all of the electioneering, they call it, going on in Latin America, whether it's in Mexico or in Central America or South America. I mean, we're controlling the governments down there. Most recently in Brazil, we helped in getting rid of the pseudo-unfriendly president and replaced the president with some corrupt, unelected official. We're going to start taking some calls. I got a couple people calling in. If you do call in, make sure you keep your microphone muted, and we'll come to you based on your area code. But we do have a caller right now from 636 area code. How's it going? You're on the Anti-Media Radio. What do you want to talk about?
Hey, man, I want to talk about how Hillary Clinton, she's just a really good liar. I mean, that's all there is to it, man. She's better than Donald Trump at putting the face on the TV, you know what I'm saying? People think she cares about Muslims or Mexicans or black people, man. I guarantee you, off the TV, she's worse than Donald Trump, man.
Yeah,
in the Secret Services, she abused her husband, you know what I'm saying? They said they heard him getting assaulted by her when they were in the White House back when he was president. That's all it is. She's just a better actor than he is, you know. She's just straightforward, says what needs to be said. She just puts on this fake face on the TV, you know.
Yeah, man, great point. Really good point. I actually wrote an article a while back about about why Hillary Clinton is actually responsible for the rise of Trump, because the stuff that Trump says, the reason that it's resonating with people is because policies that Clinton has basically either voted for or carried out, whether her time in the Senate when she voted for the war in Iraq, or whether her time at, you know, as Secretary of State, where she helped engineer the Syrian civil war, or the overthrow of Gaddafi in Libya. You know, these are things that created these refugee crises that, you know, Trump is now capitalizing on. You know, and so various ways, you know, Clinton has caused the rise of Trump. The other thing is her support of NAFTA. I mean, looking back during Bill Clinton's administration, you know, Hillary Clinton was a huge proponent of NAFTA. And if you look at the immigration crisis coming out of Mexico, it came from the decimation of the farming peasant industry down in Mexico. It used to be a huge, diverse farming community, you know, all the corn and stuff that was grown in Mexico. That industry was destroyed after NAFTA was put in place, because U.S. subsidized a bunch of crops, and so the U.S. growers were able to supply it much, much cheaper than the Mexican growers were able to, because they weren't subsidized. And so NAFTA opened the window for us to decimate the farming community down in Mexico. Where do you think all those farmers are trying? Where do you think all those farmers are trying to go? You know what I mean? They weren't trying to just sit around and starve to death to go homeless. They were like, well, you know, we got to look for greener pastures. They started coming up to the United States. So, I mean, that's one factor where Clinton has really helped Trump on this whole, you know, deportation, restricting immigration, building a wall. I mean, that's where, you know, Trump gets it from, is from NAFTA. And that's why it's working, because of all the immigration. Couple that with the fact that the U.S. economy has been in decline, and, you know, especially after the 2008 crisis, we've never fully recovered, and manufacturing jobs are no longer really an American thing. I mean, that's all that stuff has been shipped either down to Mexico, or it's been shipped off to China and other places. That's where all the manufacturing is done now. I mean, we still have some manufacturing here in the United States, but even the little manufacturing that's left, it's being automated. It's all going to be done by robots in the very, very near future. In fact, I just saw an article. I think it's Adidas or one of these shoe companies is now making its entire factory out of robots, and, you know, this is the type of stuff that's going to be happening. So that's why Trump is resonating on his anti-immigration rhetoric, is because of NAFTA. Clinton was a very big part in cheerleading for that. I have a clip.
What's going to happen if the TPP goes in and Clinton gets in? Do people realize all manufacturing is gone in this country? I mean, you want to see something then, watch. You'll see immigration out of here.
Exactly. Exactly, man. The TPP is just an extension, or, you know, they call it NAFTA on steroids for a reason. I mean, it's just NAFTA, but much larger, more complex, and much more, many more countries. I mean, it's like, what, 40 to 60% of the global GDP. We are going to take some more calls. First, I'm going to play this clip. The call-in number is 718-717-8296. If you do call in, make sure you mute your microphone and turn off the radio, and then we'll come to you based on your area code. And don't try to troll us, because it's not going to happen. I got a clip here on Hillary Clinton on NAFTA. Let's see what she has to say.
Critics blame NAFTA for the loss of manufacturing jobs in industrial states, including Ohio and Pennsylvania.
I have been a critic of NAFTA from the very beginning.
Clinton helped get NAFTA approved. She held at least 5 meetings to strategize about how to win congressional approval. She helped the White House block opposition from labor and environmental groups. And she was the featured speaker at a crucial meeting. Participants in that event said, quote, her remarks were totally pro-NAFTA. There was no equivocation for her support for NAFTA at the time.
It is not enough just to criticize NAFTA, which I have, and for some years now. I have put forth a very specific plan. Neither of us voted on this. That wasn't something either of us got to cast an independent vote on. I didn't have a public position on it because I was part of the administration.
Oh, I think that everybody is in favor of free and fair trade, and I think that NAFTA is proving its worth.
You wrote about as a...
Anyway, you see the hypocrisy there. Oh, I was against NAFTA the whole time, but yet she's making all kinds of speeches while she's, you know, Bill Clinton's wife, while he's president, you know, saying how much she loves NAFTA and how awesome it's going to be for everybody and all that stuff. You know, total, again, like the caller said, I had to drop the call because I don't know what happened. He was like yelling and screaming in the background, but she's just better at lying. I mean, Trump is, if Trump isn't self-sabotaging, like if he isn't losing on purpose, he's just being too open about what he plans on doing, which is bombing the shit out of the Middle East and deporting the shit out of immigrants and, you know, being discriminant against Muslims and stuff in the United States. These are all things that we're already doing. The United States is already spying on mosques. The NYPD is embroiled in a huge scandal because they purposely stereotype Muslims and black people. I mean, they're already doing all that stuff. Obama has deported more people than any other president in recent times. So, you know, stuff that is already being done by the government, Trump is just saying that he wants to do it, and the media is like, oh my God, I can't believe Trump is saying he's going to torture people, even though we just turned the other way as the United States waterboarded the shit out of all kinds of Muslim people in Iraq and in Afghanistan, Guantanamo Bay. You know, and it's such a big show, man. This stuff, it's just like a huge wrestling match where it's like, oh my God, Trump said bad stuff, and Obama.
I want to see Trump versus Clinton wrestling.
Yeah, that'd be a good one. Clinton is so now that she would probably lose really quickly. We got another call from 314. How's it going? You're on the Anti-Media Radio. What do you want to talk about?
Hey, man, it's funny how Donald Trump. You know, people get offended when he talks bad about Muslims. But then you look at Hillary Clinton, and she's responsible for literally thousands of deaths in Libya and the fall of Gaddafi. Killed all those Muslims. And people are worried about a couple of words Donald Trump says, trying to stop this terrorist ISIS from smuggling in with the refugees. I mean, that's basically what the Jews want. They control all Hillary Clinton. The Zionist control, man. You got to think. Keep talking about the Zionists. You guys must be controlled opposition. You don't mention them that much. As well as the Federal Reserve, the control over the Goldman Sachs and the banks, the global politicians, and Morgan Freeman. Peace out, Bill.
Yeah, man. I mean, you know, great point. And that's one of the points I was trying to make here is regarding Libya. Again, one of the things Trump resonates with is his anti, you know, blocking Muslims from coming into the country. You know, this is a reason why Trump is resonating is because Hillary Clinton and what she did in Libya. A lot of the refugees coming out of the Muslim countries right now are coming from Libya. In fact, it's like every week we see another incident of a boat overturning that's trying to reach Europe from Libya. Full of refugees, and is there extremists mixing in with these refugees? I mean, of course, why wouldn't there be? But none of this stuff would be happening at all had it not been for Hillary Clinton's war in Libya. And looking back through the emails, looking back through what we know about what went on in Libya, I mean, from what I've seen, Obama was reluctant to go into Libya. It was Hillary Clinton that was really pushing it on him, and so finally he caved in and said, "Okay, let's do what Hillary wants to do in Libya." And now we see the result. We have a failed country, refugee crisis, ISIS is in there, a bunch of extremists. I mean, the people that we're backing over there, the people that the U.S. was backing in the fight against Gaddafi. I mean, there was plenty of reports that showed that these people were hardline Islamists, people that we supposedly shouldn't be helping out if you believe our policy of, you know, trying to promote democracy, open societies and things like that, secularism and all that stuff. We're backing the wrong players. I mean, same thing is going on right now in Syria. We're backing very, very questionable groups. One of them recently beheaded a 10, 12-year-old boy.
Nick, there's even talk that they've been eating people, dude. It's that bad.
Nothing surprises me at this point. Again, we're backing the wrong groups. Thank you all for tuning in. Thanks for the call. Really great call. We'll be back with you on Wednesday. Go.
I'ma let them know, no, through the stereo. Yo, here we go, go through the stereo, stereo.
My name